You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Becoming the Archangel Michael's Companions, Rudolf Steiner's Challenge to the Younger Generation. This is Lecture 5, given in Stuttgart on October 7, 1922. Yesterday I tried to characterize the spiritual life at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries as I experienced it, and this experience led to the writing of my title, Philosophy of Freedom, and the title Steiner Books has it as now is Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, also on this website. This book was intended to point to moral intuitions as that within humanity which, in the evolution of the world, should lead to the founding of the moral life of the future. In other words, through my book I wanted to show that the time has come in which morality can continue in the evolution of humanity in no other way than that an appeal is made to the moral impulses which each human being is able to call forth individually from his or her innermost being. I mentioned that the philosophy of freedom was published at a time when it was universally said that finally it had been recognized that moral intuitions were impossible, and that any discussion about moral intuitions must once and for all be silenced. I considered it essential to establish the justification and grounds for moral intuition. Thus there was a distinct cleft between what the age, in many of its most eminent minds, considered to be truth, and what I held to be right on the basis of human evolution. On what is this difference really based? Let us look into the depths of human soul life as it is formed today in the West. In earlier times, people also spoke of moral intuitions. That is to say, it was said that, as individuals, people could call forth from within themselves, independent of external life, the impetus to action. However, in the first third of the 15th century, and even more so in subsequent centuries, what was said about moral intuitions was less and less true. It was said that morality could not be established by the observation of external facts. People could no longer perceive of a real light when they looked into their inner being. Thus, they declared that moral intuitions were there, but that actually they knew nothing about them anymore. For centuries, the thinking that existed and was justified before the 15th century rolled on automatically, so that the facts that people declared to be right had ceased to be so. The traditions of which I have spoken persisted through the centuries and contributed to such statements. Before the 15th century, people did not speak in indefinite, the indefinite was already the untruthful, terms, as was current later. When speaking of intuitions, also of moral intuitions, people spoke of what rose up within their inner beings, of which they had a picture as real as the picture of reality they had when they opened their eyes in the morning and looked at nature. Outside they saw nature around them, the plants and the clouds. When they looked into their inner beings, there arose the spiritual, which included the moral as a given. The further we go back in evolution, the more we find that the rising up of an inner existence in human experience was a matter of course. These facts, as I have explained them to you, which result from spiritual science, may also be studied historically by considering certain outer symptoms. In the days when speaking about an inner reality was lapsing into untruthfulness, proof for the existence of God arose. Had anyone, during the first centuries of Christianity, spoken about proofs for the existence of God, as Anselm of Canterbury did, no one would have known what was meant. In earlier times, they would have known still less, for in the second or third century before Christ, to speak of proof for the existence of God would have been as if someone sitting there in the first row were to stand up and I were to say, Mr. X stands there, and someone in the room were to assert, no, that must first be proved. What human beings experienced as the divine was a being of full reality standing before their souls. They were endowed with the faculty of perception for that which they called divine. The divine of that historical time appears primitive and incomplete in the eyes of modern people. They could not get beyond the point, but the people of that age would not have wanted to hear about proofs, for that would have seemed absurd. Human beings began to, in quotes, prove the existence of the divine only when they had lost it, when it was no longer perceived by inner spiritual perception. The introduction of proofs for the existence of God shows, if one looks at the facts impartially, the direct perception of the divine had been lost. However, the moral impulses of that time were bound up with what was divine. Moral impulses of that time can no longer be regarded as moral impulses for today. When, in the first third of the 15th century, the faculty of perception of the divine spiritual, in the old sense, was exhausted, perception of the moral also dried up, and all that remained was the traditional dogma of morals, which people called conscience. The term always referred to something that was highly vague, however. When, therefore, at the end of the 19th century, it was said that all talk about moral intuitions must be silenced, it was the final consequence of an historical development. Until then, human beings had a feeling, however dim, that such intuitions had once existed. But now they began to put themselves to the test. Intelligence had at least brought them to the point of being able to do this. They discovered that with the methods they were accustomed to use to think scientifically, they were unable to come to moral intuitions. Let us consider the moral intuitions of olden times. History has become very threadbare in this respect. We have a history of outer events, and in the 19th century we endeavored to establish a history of culture. But this age has been incapable of producing a history that takes the inner life of the soul into account. There is therefore no knowledge of how soul life developed from the earliest times until the first third of the 15th century. However, if we go back in time and consider what was spoken of as moral intuition, we find that it did not arise as a result of inner human effort. For this reason, the Old Testament, for instance, did not feel what figured then as moral intuition as acquired by the human soul, but as divine commandments coming into the soul from outside. And the further back we go, the more human beings felt that what they saw when they beheld the moral was an inner gift from a living divine being outside themselves. Moral intuitions held good as divine commands, not in a figurative or symbolic sense, but in an absolutely real sense. There is a good deal of truth in certain contemporary religious philosophies when they allude to a primal revelation preceding the historical age on earth. External science cannot get much beyond, shall I say, a paleontology of the soul. Just as in the earth we find fossils, indicating an earlier form of life, so in fossilized moral ideas we find forms pointing back to the once living, God-given moral ideas. Thus we can come to the concept of primal revelation and say this primal revelation dried up. Human beings lost the ability to be conscious of the primal revelation. And this loss reached its point of culmination in the first third of the 15th century. Human beings perceived nothing anymore when they looked within themselves. They preserved only the tradition of what they had once beheld. Religious communities gradually seized upon this tradition and turned its externalized content, this purely traditional content, into dogmas which people were expected merely to believe, whereas formerly they had living experience of their truth as coming from outside of the human being. The very significant situation at the end of the 19th century was that certain circles realized that the old God-given intuitions were no longer there. They realized that if someone wanted to prove with the head the ideas of the people of old, then he or she would have to say that there are no moral intuitions. Science has silenced them. Human beings, even when receptive, are no longer capable of receiving moral intuitions. To be consistent, one would have had to become a kind of Spengler and say that there are no moral intuitions, and that in future humanity will have no alternative but gradually to wither up. One would perhaps at best ask one's grandfather, "Have you heard that there were once moral intuitions, moral influences?" And the grandfather would answer, "One would have to search the libraries at second or third hand. One might still glean some knowledge of moral intuitions, but no longer from actual experience." One would then have to say that there is no alternative but to wither up and become senile, not to have youth any more. That would have been consistent. But people did not dare, for consistency was not an outstanding quality of the dawning age of the intellect. Indeed, there were many things that one did not dare. If a judgment were pronounced, it was only half given, as in the case of Dubois Raymond, who delivered a speech about the boundaries of the knowledge of nature. He said that supernaturalism could not be mentioned in connection with natural science, for supernaturalism was faith and not knowledge. Science stops short of the supernatural, and nothing further was said by him on the subject. If mentioned, people got excited and said it was no longer science. Consistency was not a characteristic of the century then ending. So, on one hand, there was the alternative of withering. The spiritual passes over gradually into the life of soul, the life of soul into the physical. As a result, after some decades, souls would have been able only to ferret out antiquated moral impulses. After some years, not only the 30-year-olds, but also the 20-year-olds would be going about with bald heads, and the 15-year-olds with gray hair. This is a figurative way of speaking, but that would have been Spenglerism as a practical life impulse. That was one alternative. The other was to become fully conscious that with the loss of the old intuitions, we are facing nothingness. What are we to do? In this nothingness, seek the all. Out of this very nothingness, seek something that is not given, but which we ourselves must strenuously work for. This was no longer possible with passive powers of the past, but only with the strongest powers of cognition of this age, with the cognitional powers of pure thinking. For with pure thinking, this thinking goes straight over into the will. You can observe and think without exerting your will. You can carry out experiments and think, but it does not pass over into the will. Pure thinking, that is the unfolding of primary, original activity, requires energy. There the lightning flash of will must strike directly into the thinking itself. But the lightning flash of will must come from each single individual. Courage was needed to call upon this pure thinking that becomes pure will and arises as a new faculty. The faculty of drawing out of the human individuality moral impulses that have to be worked for and are no longer given in the form of the old impulses. Intuitions must be called up that are strenuously worked for. Today what we work for in our inner being is called imagination. In this present age, which has, apart from this silenced inner work, moral impulses for the future must be produced out of moral imagination. The human being must be shown the way from the merely poetical, artistic imagination to a productive, moral imagination. The old intuitions were always given to groups. There is a mysterious connection between primal revelation and human groups. It was always to groups of human beings in association with the old intuitions were given. It was always to groups of human beings in association that the old intuitions were given. The new intuitions must be produced within each single individual human soul. In other words, each single human being must be made the source of morality. This must be brought forth through intuitions out of the nothingness which humanity is facing. That was the only possibility left if, as an honest person, one was not willing to turn to a kind of Spenglerism. And to work in the Spengler way is far from alive. It was a question of finding a living reality out of the nothingness that confronted human beings. And it goes without saying that at first one could only make a beginning. For a creative power in the human being had to be called upon, the creation, as it were, of an inner person within the outer person. In earlier times, the outer person received moral impulses from outside. Now the human being had to create an inner person, and with this inner person there came, or will come, the new moral intuition. So out of the times themselves, there had to be born a kind of philosophy of freedom, something that must inevitably stand in sharp opposition to the times. Let us complete this survey of the condition of the soul of modern humanity by considering another aspect. You see, as a preparation for intellectualism in Western civilization, the consciousness of a human being's pre-earthly existence had already been wiped out for a long time. It was taken from Western civilization in very early times. So in the West, there was not this consciousness. Quote, "When I issue from the embryonic state of physical development, something unites itself with me, something that descends from the heights of spirit and soul and permeates this physical earthly being." Close quote. Now in this connection, the following presents itself quite clearly to our vision. I have already given you a picture to elucidate it. I said that when we look at a corpse, we know that it cannot have its form through the forces of nature, but must be the remains of a living human being. It would be foolish to speak about the form of the human body as if it were itself something living. We must go back to what was the living human being. In the same way, looked at impartially, intellectual thinking presents itself as dead. People naturally will say, "Prove this for us." It proves itself in the very beholding, and the kind of proofs necessary, which are actual only for the side issues, are indeed available. But to demonstrate it, I would have to go into a good deal of philosophy, and this lies outside the scope of our present task. To anyone looking at it without prejudice, intellectual thinking, out of which our whole modern civilization flows, bears the same relation to living thinking as the corpse does to the living human being. Just as the corpse is derived from the living human being, so the thinking we have today is derived from the living thinking of an earlier time. But upon sound reflection, I must say to myself, this dead thinking must have originated in a living thinking that was there before birth. The physical organism is the tomb of the living thinking, and the receptacle of dead thinking. But the strange fact is that during the first two periods of human life, up to the 6th, 7th, or 8th years, to the end of the change of teeth, and then further up to the 13th, 14th, 15th years, that is to say, to the age of puberty, the human being's thinking is not completely dead, but it is in the process of dying. It was only living thinking in pre-earthly existence. During the first two periods of life, it comes to the point of dying. And for modern humanity, since the first third of the 15th century, thinking is quite dead by the time of puberty. It is then the corpse of living thinking. It was not always so in the evolution of humanity. If we go back before the 15th century, it becomes evident that thinking still was something living. There existed the kind of living thinking that human beings today do not like, because they feel as if ants were swarming in their brain. They do not like it when something is really alive within them. They want their head to behave in a quiet and comfortable way. The thinking in it, too, should take a peaceful course, so that all one needs is to help things along with the laws of logic. But pure thinking, that is just as if an anthill were in one's head, and that, people say, is not healthy. At the beginning of the 15th century, the human being was still able to endure living thinking. I am not saying this in order to criticize. That would be out of place, just as out of place as to criticize a cow because she is no longer a calf. It would have been the greatest disaster for humanity if this had not happened. There had to be human beings who could not endure having an anthill in their head. For what was dead had to be brought to life again, in a different way. And so it came about after the middle of the 15th century that human beings inwardly experienced a dead thinking once puberty was past. They were filled out with the corpse of thinking. Go really deeply and seriously into this idea, and you will understand that it is only since that time that an inorganic natural science could arise, because the human being began to grasp purely inorganic laws only as of that time. Now, for the first time, humanity could grasp what is dead in the way striven for since Galileo and Copernicus. The living had first to die inwardly. When people were still inwardly alive in their thinking, they could not grasp the dead in an external way, for the living kind of knowledge imparted itself to what was external. Natural science became increasingly pure science and nothing more. And this continued until, at the end of the 19th century, it was almost only mathematics. That was the ideal toward which it strove. It strove to be a kind of system of pure mechanics. So, in the modern age, people began more and more to make what is dead into the actual object of knowledge. That was the whole aim. This lasted for some centuries, but evolution took this direction. People of genius like La Mettrie, for example, said as if prophetically that human beings were really just machines. La Mettrie is a name, La Mettrie, let me spell that name, D-E and then capital L-A-M-E-T-T-R-E-I, La Mettrie. Sorry, I'm making that up. Yes, human beings who only want to grasp what is dead avail themselves of what is merely a machine within themselves, of what is dead within themselves. And this makes the development of natural science easy for modern human beings. The thinking is dead by the time of puberty, whereas in earlier days they had God-given intuitions, because thinking preserved the forces of growth within itself far beyond puberty. Today human beings lose this living thinking after puberty. Thus in later life they learn nothing more. They simply repeat mechanically what they had acquired in earlier youth. You see, this suited the old, who held the control of culture in their hands, to comprehend a dead world with dead thinking. With this dead thinking, science can be founded marvelously. However, one can never teach or educate the young with it. And why? Because up to puberty, the young preserve the livingness of thinking, if even in an unconscious way. And so, in spite of all the thought given today to principles of education, if rigidified objective science, which comprehends only what is dead, becomes the teacher of the living, of the youthful, the young feel it like a thorn in the flesh. One thrusts this thorn, the death, into their heart, and they are supposed to tear out from their heart what is living. Many still overlook what has had to come about out of the depths of human evolution, a definite cleft between the young and the old. And this cleft is due to the fact that the young cannot allow the dead thorn to be thrust into their living heart, the thorn that the head produces out of intellectualism. The young demand the livingness that can only come out of the spirit as the result of strenuous effort by the individual. We are making a beginning in the sphere of moral intuitions. If a beginning has been made in what I have tried to present in my philosophy of freedom, in regard to what is purely spiritual, for such moral intuitions striven for by human individuality are purely spiritual, and if one has dared to open one's mouth while others were saying nothing should be said, the powers that ordained that one should be stopped from speaking of moral intuitions will themselves be silenced. And so I called upon the living, the purely spiritual. Science is dead. Science cannot make what is living flow from the mouth. And without this, one cannot build on it. One must appeal to an inner livingness, and so one must really begin to seek. The divine lies precisely in the appeal to the original moral spiritual intuitions. But if one has once grasped the spiritual, then one can unfold the forces that enable one to grasp the spirit in wider spheres of cosmic existence. And that is the straight path from moral intuitions to other spiritual contents. In my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds, I have tried to show that knowledge of the supersensible worlds is built up gradually out of imaginative, inspired, and intuitive experience. If we look at outer nature, we reach first imagination, then inspiration, and lastly intuition. In the moral world, it is different. If in that world we reach picture consciousness, imaginations as such, then with the imaginations we have at the same time develop the faculty for moral intuitions. Already here at the first stage, we acquire what is not attained until the third stage in the other. In the moral world, intuition follows immediately upon outer perception. In the world of nature, however, there are two intermediate stages. So that if in the moral world one speaks of intuitions, not in mere phrases, but honestly, truthfully, one simply cannot do otherwise than recognize these intuitions as being purely spiritual. But then one must work further to discover the other realms of the spirit. For what one has grasped qualitatively in moral intuition is the same as what one fills with content for natural evolution, with esoteric science, if you will. We must proceed as follows. On the one hand, we must acknowledge that outer science, by its very nature, can only comprehend what is material. Hence the view of the material must be not only materialism, but also phenomenalism. On the other, we must work to bring life back into what has been made into dead thinking by natural science. Thus certain scriptural words become alive on a higher level. I do not want to intersperse what I say in a sentimental way with words from the Bible, but only to elucidate some things. Why is it that today we no longer have any real philosophies? It is because thinking, as I have described it, has died. When based merely upon dead thinking, philosophies are dead from the very outset. They are not alive. And if people like Bergson seek something living in philosophy, nothing comes of it, because although they struggle for it, they cannot lay hold of the living. To grasp the living means first to attain vision. What we need to reach the living is what can be added out of what worked within us before our 15th year. This, from before our 15th year, is not disturbed by our intellect. We must carry what works within us as spontaneous living wisdom over into the dead thinking. Dead thinking must be permeated with forces of growth and with reality. For this reason, and not out of sentimentality, I want to refer to the words from the Bible, quote, "Except ye become as little children, ye cannot enter the kingdom of heaven," close quote. For it is always the kingdom of heaven that one is seeking. But if one does not become like the child before puberty, one cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. Childlikeness, youthfulness, must be brought into dead thinking. Thereby it becomes alive. It comes once more to intuitions. Thus we learn to speak out of the primal wisdom of the child. Out of a science of language, such as Fritz Mautner has written, not only are moral intuitions silenced, but also actually all talk about the world. People ought to stop talking about the world, because Mautner proves that all talk about the world consists only of words, and words are incapable of expressing reality. Such thinking has made its appearance only since the first third of the 19th century, People do not consider what it would be like if our words and concepts not only meant something, but had real existence. Then, indeed, they would not be transparent. Then, like clouded lenses before our eyes, they would conceal what is sense perceptible, because they are realities that would hide the world from us. Something splendid would be made of human beings if they had concepts and words that have meaning in and of themselves. They would have been held fast by them. Concepts and words must be transparent, so that we may reach the things through them. It is imperative, when the desire is almost universal to silence all talk about reality, that we learn to speak a new language. In this sense, we must return to childhood and learn a new language. The language we learn in the first years of childhood gradually becomes dead, because it becomes permeated by dead intellectual concepts. We must quicken it to new life. We must find something that strikes into what we are thinking, just as when we learned to speak, an impulse arose in us out of the unconscious. We must seek a science that is alive. We should consider it a matter of course that the thinking that reached its apex in the last third of the 19th century silences our moral intuitions. We must learn to open our mouth by letting our lips be moved by the Spirit. Then we shall become children again, that is to say, we shall carry childhood on into our later years, and that is what we must do. If a youth movement wants to have truth and not only phraseology, then such a movement is imbued of necessity with a longing for the human mouth to be opened by the Spirit, a longing for the quickening of human speech by the Spirit which wells forth from the individual. As a first step, individual moral intuitions must be brought out of the human individuality. We shall then see how, as a result, the true science of the Spirit, which makes all anthropology into anthroposophy, is born. The end of Lecture 5.